Our topic tonight is on grace and healing. And many wonder, what is the connection between the spiritual and the physical? How does grace relate to healing? And if there's a connection, what is it? This is a chapter found in Ministry of Healing called The Physician and Educator. I'll not be talking about physicians alone tonight, but all of us together. The needs of humanity regarding health are tremendous, and they're related to the spiritual. If you read on page 129 of Ministry of Healing, you'll discover some of the needs. One of the most deplorable effects of the original apostasy was the loss of man's power of self-control. He lost his Eden home, he lost many things, but one of the most deplorable effects of the original apostasy was the loss of man's power of self-control. Only as this power is regained can there be real progress. When Adam sinned, all lost the power of self-control. Is there anyone here who does not know he's lost that power? Or she has lost it? If you don't know, someone labor with you. You really are sound asleep, not stone cold. We've all lost a long time ago the power of self-control, and only a real Pharisee would think he does have it. For we fail in so many, many respects when it comes to self-control. And this is a difficult thing. Paul talked about, I believe, in Romans 7, verses 19 and 23, about this lack of self-control. Romans 7, 19. For the good that I would, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do. He knows what to do, but he can't do it, right? He knows what he should not do, but he cannot avoid doing it. Isn't that right? It isn't a lack of knowledge or education, it's a lack of ability. That what I want to do, I can do, and that what I do not want to do, I seem to do. And then verse 23, he sums it up. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. I'm a slave to these things in my body, or members, as the King James calls it. And even though my mind thinks something else, the mind is in captivity to the body. Totally helpless. The loss of self-control is a tragic thing. Sometimes we call this the enslaving aspect of sin, the bondage of sin, as we often call it. And man was weakened by his own transgression to the place he lost self-control. He knows what he ought to do, and he knows what he ought not to do, but he just can't get it. How do we regain self-mastery or self-control? How do we regain that? That's a very good question for everybody, isn't it? If you have too much self-control, you may leave right now and come back and lecture to us for 5 hours, if you'd like to, later on. If you're one that surpasses in this, you know, and we hope that you are not ignorant of your needs, but if you do know how, tell somebody about it. Make sure you're right. How do we regain self-mastery, self-control? It continues on the very same quotation on page 130. I just read the bottom of page 129 a minute ago. Now we begin to see the connection in grace and health. The body is the only medium through which the mind and the soul are developed for the upbuilding of character. The body is the only medium through which the mind and the soul are developed for the upbuilding of character. So whatever happens to our character and our body and our mind and soul is developed. It's all developed inside of our bodies, right? This is the box, the carriage, whatever you want to call it, in which is housed. And so the mind is dependent on the body. Character must be developed in these bodies of ours over which we lack this self-control. Hence it is that the adversary of souls directs his temptations to the enfeebling and degrading of the physical powers. The adversary directs his temptations to enfeeble and degrade the physical powers. He doesn't like your body because in getting at your body, he can control your mind and your soul. So he attacks our bodies. He seeks to enfeeble and degrade the physical powers. His success here with the body, you see, physically, his success here means the surrender to evil of the whole being. If he can only conquer these bodies of ours physically, the whole being is conquered by evil powers. We're totally the tool of the devil. The tendencies of our physical nature, unless under the dominion of a higher power, will surely work ruin and death. Now, the devil knows more about this system of getting at the mind and the character than we do. And he seeks to attack our spiritual development by attacking our bodies. If he's successful in weakening our bodies, he knows he'll destroy us spiritually too. And this is why Seventh-day Adventists believe that health reform is a very, very prominent part of spirituality. And while we've always taught it for many, many years now, decades, it's an important part, far more important than any Seventh-day Adventist realizes. We know we have this health message, but we use it so little. We think it's a no-no, and it isn't. It's a tremendous amount of grace to save our souls. And it was intended to save our souls, not just to make us better than somebody else physically. Health reform is to save souls, not just to get better bodies alone, although we'll do that too. And if we do not recognize its value in saving our own souls, we have much to learn, very much. And unfortunately, we've almost thrown the whole thing away so far as our soul salvation is concerned. And it's become nothing but a restriction, sort of a pharisaical demand, you see, an exaction on us. And we do not see the value of it in the salvation of souls, which the Lord intended us to see. And yet this is very, very important. We must have it, or we'll find ourselves lost. On the bottom of page 128, these thoughts continue about Satan in our bodies. We are waging a warfare upon which hang eternal results, the bottom of that page, page 128. We have unseen enemies to meet. Evil angels are striving for the dominion of every human being. Whatever injures the health not only lessens the physical vigor, but tends to weaken the mental and moral powers. Whatever injures the health not only lessens physical vigor, but tends to weaken the mental and moral powers. Indulgence in any unhealthful practice makes it more difficult for one to discriminate between right and wrong, and hence more difficult to resist evil. It increases the danger of failure and defeat. So again, the devil attacks the body, the physical. By getting at that, he's going in a roundabout way to destroy our souls, the mental and the spiritual, see, or the moral, as it's called here. He knows this so very, very well, and we sometimes just let him get by with murder. And say, I'll eat what I want to and do whatever I want to my physical habits. That has nothing to do with my spiritual things. The devil said, I'm sure glad you think so. But the Lord doesn't say that. The devil says that. And we go along thinking we're doing fine, you know. And he laughs at us in our ignorance. For we think sometimes we're wiser than he is when he really outsmarts us so very, very often. Now, in Romans 7, verses 24 and 25, it tells you how you begin to regain this ascendancy or this self-mastery. 24 and 5. He laments it, O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? This body that seems to control my mind, the law of my members, you see, that captivates my mind. Who's going to deliver me from this body? And he says in the first phrase, the next verse, I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. The way I'm delivered from this body that drags me down to destruction is through Christ. That's the way it's accomplished. There is no other way. In 1 Corinthians 9:27, our scripturing tonight, which Brother Pangborn read for us, 1 Corinthians 9:27, just that one verse, pulling it out of the scripture reading. Paul says, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest when he's preached he himself should be a castaway. I bring in this objection. How? Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Now this process, this sequence of events by which we regain self-control is described here in this chapter. And it's one of the most important things in all the book. In fact, it's one of the most important things in all of Christianity. For we become so frustrated and guilty unless we learn self-control that we'll give up in disgust and discouragement. And many are already doing that, and we think they don't believe. They believe, but they've never found self-control. They don't know where it's at. So sometimes not a lack of belief, it's a lack of the power. And so this is discussed on page 130 and 131. The second paragraph, first of all, on page 130. The body is to be brought into subjection. Paul says, I keep my body under, you see, I bring in subjection. It's to be brought into subjection. How? The higher powers of the being are to rule. And rule means to dominate. It means to tell the body what to do and what not to do. Not the body tell the mind what to do. The higher powers are to rule. The higher powers of your body are your mind. It's to be the boss. The body is not to be the boss. Your taste is not to boss you. Your eyes are not to boss you. Or your ears or your touch, whatever it is, they're not to boss you. Or your passions. The mind is to be the boss. If I may put it in that colloquial way. Isn't that right? The mind is to be the king of the life. It says the body, the higher powers of the being are to rule. The passions are to be controlled by the will. Controlled by the will, which is itself to be under the control of God. Now there's a sequence that I'm coming back to. The kingly power of reason, sanctified by divine grace, is to bear sway in our lives. It's to dominate. The kingly power of reason, the will, is to control and bear sway in our lives. Bottom of the page now, page 130. Apart from divine power. Now notice back up there I read a little while ago. The passions are to be controlled by the will, which is itself to be under the control of God. Now, that under control of God is continued in the bottom of the page. Apart from divine power, the control of God, no genuine reform or change can be effected. God must bring the change. Man cannot. Human barriers against natural and cultivated tendencies are but as the sandbank against the torrent. So anything you try to do of yourself, any hindrances you put up or any attempts to stop, are like a sandbank against a flood, you see. It'll never be effective. Not until the life of Christ becomes a vitalizing power in our lives can we resist the temptations that assail us from within and from without. So the life of Christ must become a vitalizing power, or we can never resist these temptations. Christ came to this world and lived the law of God, that man might have perfect mastery over the natural inclinations which corrupt the soul. I'm on the top of page 131 now. The physician of soul and body, and that is a capital P on physician, the physician of soul and body, he gives victory over warring lusts. Now, where does the victory come in the power? He gives victory over warring lusts. He has provided every facility. He gives victory. He has provided every facility that man may possess completeness of character. So it's a provision, a facility that Christ provides. It's not something we have of ourselves. It's something he gives to us, called a vitalizing power, a few sentences back. Now it goes on and describes this. When one surrenders to Christ, the mind is brought under the control of the law. But it is the royal law. What does royal mean? Kingly, what does a king do? Rules. So it's the royal or ruling or dominating law. You see? It says, the mind is brought under the control of the law, but it is the royal, the ruling law, you see, which proclaims liberty to every captive. When he dominates by his law, liberty comes, you see. By becoming one with Christ, man is made free. Subjection to the will of Christ means restoration to perfect manhood. Obedience to God is liberty from the thraldom of sin, deliverance from human passion and impulse. Man may stand conqueror of himself, conqueror of his own inclinations, conqueror of principalities and powers, and of the rulers of the darkness of this world, and of spiritual wickedness in high places. Man may stand a conqueror. Now, all the steps are given here in these three paragraphs I've been reading for you. You must think these through very clearly. The whole heart of the health message, the reason for it, is here in these two pages. Everything is right there. The devil knows that there's no way we can have self-control unless we keep our bodies under. He knows that. So he attacks the body to make it weaker and weaker, to succumb to various physical habits. And then he knows he has you defeated so far as any triumph of your soul, completely defeated. And many of us are fooling ourselves and think we have victory when our bodies are slaves. We don't have victory. You might think you do, and the devil's laughing out loud. Very loud, too, these days. He knows you don't as long as he can slave the body. He knows that. For the body will drag the mind and soul right down with it. And so the devil attacks the body. What can we do? The body must be brought into subjection. But there's no way I can control it. Oh, wretched man that I am, who'll deliver him in this body that drags me down to death, you see? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So he goes on and says, the higher powers of the being are to rule. The higher powers of our body are minds and our will. So he said, the body must be subjected and controlled by the will. So I will to stop sinning? No, I don't. Many of you tried that for years and years and years and years. And even the strong will can only stop some sins. And they still like to do those sins afterward. But we will to give our wills to whom? To Jesus. We will to do his will. We make him king of our lives. We make ourselves his possession, his property. And we say, take charge of your property. Take command. The devil claims me as his property, and he takes charge. That's why I sin. When I choose to become the property of Christ, he takes charge, and that's why I do righteousness. Is that right? It depends on to whom I've given my will. So my will must be subjection to him. Then that will must control the body by the power of Christ. And then the devil is defeated in the body, you see, as well as in the soul and the mind. And so it's the sequence of steps. The will is given to Christ. Then Christ has access. Christ has control, then the body is controlled by Christ in me, the hope of glory. Then the devil has a terrible time fighting Christ, because he's already been defeated by Jesus, hasn't he? This is the sequence of steps that you must understand very, very well. My reason can only function and be a ruler through Christ controlling my reason. The kingly power of reason, it says, sanctified by divine grace, set apart for him to use. You see, it becomes a controlling power of the mind. But if not sanctified by divine grace, it's just a slave to the body. Until Christ has the mind, the will, and the reason, I accomplish nothing for him. I go on and on in slavery and cannot escape. Now that paragraph on page 131 is most interesting. When one surrenders to Christ, the mind is rather control of the law. It's the royal law and so on. And then victory is mine. In the Christian life, surrender is victory. Defeat of self is triumph through Christ. Success of self is failure. Defeat of self is success. Isn't that right? When I surrender to Jesus and he conquers my soul, I'm free for the first time. When I do his thing and not my own thing, I'm suddenly at liberty. As long as I do my own thing, I'm a slave. Always. It's not until self is defeated and self surrenders to Christ and makes Christ triumphant that I'm free in Jesus. If the Son shall make you free, you're what? You really are free. There's no other freedom like that. The thing we fight so much is the surrender of self. And we never get too old to fight the battle for self, do we? Do we? Some of you older than I am. Are you too old to still be fighting for self? Always defending self. Every little squabble around the house, what do? Defend ourselves. Every little contention at work, where you might be criticized as being wrong, what do? Defend ourselves. We have pride of opinion, you know, all kinds of discussions and arguments, all sorts of things in which we always are contending for self. What are we advertising? Self isn't dead, and self has not surrendered. That's what we're saying. Not at all. And some of us bristle terribly when someone would try to deny that we're right and accuse of being wrong. We just really become furious then. Get out of the way. It's like a volcano erupting, you know, burns everybody that gets near it. Hot ashes falling down on everybody, and they feel them. All because of self, you see. Defending self. Is there anything in self worthwhile defending? But we all think so, don't we? We all think there's something in self that must be defended. What is there worthwhile defending in self? What is it? When you finish in a hot argument defending yourself, how do you feel? Stupid is the word, I suppose, or worse. I feel terrible, you know. Why did I battle away like that, you know? That was a foolish discussion argument. It made no sense at all. Why did I get upset? Why did I say those words? Why did I accuse the other person? Why, you know? No rational reasons. All defense of self. Then we feel embarrassed that we embarrassed ourselves. And that's more defense of self, isn't it? Always trying to keep self looking better, as though there was something to fix up. Self is an abominable thing. It really is. Jesus came and died to self, and he had nothing wrong in himself, did he? But he died to self as our divine example. If there's anything for Christ to forget about himself, we just have tons to forget, don't we, and deny. Everything in self is abhorrent. And the one thing that will prevent us from going to heaven is self. It'll never be our spouses or our neighbors or our parents or our children or our teachers or somebody else. It'll never be. It'll be ourselves. It'll be the love of self that prevents us from getting into heaven. I thank God that I'm not like other men are. I'm ineligible. I'm not justified. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. He went down justified, Jesus said. Lord, Lord, open that to us. We cast out devils, healed the sick, done many wonderful things in your name. He said, I never knew you. Why does he say that? Because they say, look at the things we did. It's in your name, but look what we did. We're eligible because of what we did. All self, isn't it? He said, I don't even know who you are, and I never knew who you were. We're not related. We're not connected. We're not even friends. when self is like that, you see. Not until Christ has control of me do I become intimate with him. Otherwise, he's locked out of the life. This is the most important section of the lesson. If you learn nothing but this in all the book, Ministry of Healing, it'll be worth everything all the time you took. There's such a connection between this triumph of man and this grace of Christ that brings self-control. The surrender of the will. Lord, take me and do with me what you please. Now, gladly do what you say. How few times we say that meaningfully. We keep on trying to do our own way, you know, and afraid to do his way, as though it brings some disaster to us if we did what he wants us to do. And we always bring disaster to ourselves by doing what we want to do, right? Over and over again, we bring failure by insisting on what we want to do. Christ could never do as bad as we're doing with us. Never. Be impossible, you know. There could never be as many failures doing Christ's way as it is doing our way. It'd be impossible. And it takes us so many, many years to discover that all the ways of men, you know, are failures. All the ways. When do you work hard to get the thing you aspire to the most? And I've met so many like that. When do you get everything you've aspired to from the time you're a young person? Worked hard for many years of education, climbed the ladder, sweat, slave, labor, you know, bloody hands, everything, you know, bruised noses, everything. Brain has been taxed just to the utmost. Now you have everything you want. What's it like? I've met people like that. I've met rich people who have more than they ever anticipated, everything they want, and they're absolutely miserable. I've met those in the positions that they aspired to for years and years and years and years. I heard a man in the movie industry who told about his aspirations in a testimony one time. He said, I finally reached the pinnacle I'd been aiming for all those years. He said it was a horrible task, a horrible job when I arrived there. I was dissatisfied every minute. There was absolutely no pleasure, no joy, no happiness there at all. It was just a wretched existence. I defy you to find someone, apart from the truly spiritual, who's climbed to their aspirations, who's not disappointed. Everything that man plans for himself or herself proves to be a dismal failure when you reach it. I can recall when I wanted to fly so badly. I thought it was impossible for me. I literally was addicted to it. Growing up reading the books as a boy in the library. Just read them all the time until I just saturated this stuff. And the day came after a couple thousand hours of flying when I decided there was not much difference between me and some truck driver going down the highway with a load of gasoline, because that's what we were hauling. It wasn't much difference. And it didn't seem too dramatic to be driving a truck down the highway to me. And it seemed just about the same thing to be flying that airplane. That's the honest truth. It did. Everything can become pure drudgery. Everything. The most glamorous things in all this world. Your most beautiful dreams can become the most boresome job. And totally dissatisfying, and yet you've labored for years and years and years and years. I've met many professional people who've come to me as their pastor and said, Elder Lehman, I worked all these years to have this. I'm so dissatisfied every day I could just scream, what will I do now? I spent 30 or 40 years attaining this position, and there's just nothing here, nothing here. What do I do now? I know those who've tried to change other things and still displeased. I used to think I should envy those people, you know, that in these positions. And I began to discover when I was still quite young that they were envying me as a pastor. And I used to ask myself, why do they envy me? It just seemed a mystery to me. Why do you envy me? You know, I don't have anything going so wonderful for me. Why do you envy me? And it seemed a strange thing to me that people with so much were envying me in my position. And often they would say, I wish I could have the satisfaction in life of doing the work like you're doing. I thought, what am I doing? And little by little began to dawn on me that I had the most satisfying job in the world. And I had thought before they did. But I have hardly met a person like them who didn't envy me. And for many years I couldn't figure out why they envied me. And it dawned in my senses after a long, long time. There are very few jobs in this world where people are really thankful that you came to help them. If you get paid, they said, you got your money, what are you worried about? I don't need to thank you. You know, you took it out of my pocketbook. Why thank you? Isn't that right? But it's a little different in the Lord's work sometimes, you know. You don't get paid for it. In fact, you couldn't get enough pay to do it. And the people know that. They become very, very grateful. They identify you with the Lord who by His grace gives us all these marvelous things. Be very careful that you don't strive for all these things and find life so empty and so useless, and most of your life has gone by then. The world and the devil dangles before us some of these tasty tidbits that are just nothing but an empty shell when you have them. Just nothing there. And there are literally millions of people who can tell you all about it. They're so dissatisfied. May God help us to see there's more in life than some of these things that we think are so choice and that we find so empty. I must hasten on now. Along with learning how to obey by this grace of Christ to whom I give my will, then control my body. Along with learning how to obey, we must learn what to obey. For Seventh-day Adventists, I think, first must learn how to obey. We've taught so many what's for so long and so little how that we just have thousands and thousands of frustrated people in our churches who do not know how. They don't know where to go to find the help to do it. But they know many what's, what they ought to do and what ought not to do. But there are some people in the world who don't know how, what to obey. And we're to talk about them. And when it comes to the physical, we're not too knowledgeable sometimes ourselves. On page 129 of Ministry of Healing, this quotation is found down at the bottom of the page, 129. The progress of reform depends upon a clear recognition of fundamental truth. Now, it's not talking about so much here spiritual truth as physical. The progress of change or reform in our lives depends upon a clear recognition of fundamental truth. While on the one hand, danger lurks in a narrow philosophy and a hard, cold orthodoxy. If you understand what that means, it's talking about Pharisees. There's a danger there. On the other hand, there's a great danger in a careless liberalism. That's the permissive liberal. She describes in a beautiful way, by the way. The foundation of all enduring reform is the law of God. Now, it's a little different. It's not this hard, cold orthodoxy, and it's not this careless liberalism she's talking about in the law. She says, the foundation of all enduring reform is the law of God. We are to present in clear, distinct lines the need of obeying this law. Its principles must be kept before the people. They are as everlasting and inexorable as God Himself. Now, there's been a gross misunderstanding of the law by Seventh-day Adventists. It's a tragedy. I'll be talking a little bit about it on Sabbath. I won't enlarge now. But a correct understanding of the law and of the laws brings about progress of true reform. This is on the what we're talking about now. On page 128 of Ministry of Healing, there are more quotations of the same order. It is the duty of every... I'm sorry. Middle of page. We cannot be too often reminded that health does not depend on chance. In other words, the bugs are not just flying through the air, you know, and suddenly, and you got it. It does not depend on chance. It is a result of obedience to law. Health does not depend on chance. It's a result of obedience to law. This is recognized by the contestants in athletic games and trials of strength. These men make the most careful preparation. They submit to thorough training and strict discipline. Every physical habit is carefully regulated. They know that neglect, excess, or carelessness, which weakens or cripples any organ or function of the body, would ensure defeat. So they carefully guard all the laws of their bodies. Otherwise, there's no success in physical things. The top of the page now. It is the duty of every person for his own sake and for the sake of humanity, to inform himself in regard to the laws of life and conscientiously to obey them. It's not necessarily talking about the Ten Commandment law now. The laws of life and to conscientiously obey them. All need to become acquainted with that most wonderful of all organisms, the human body. I'm afraid we're still not teaching it as we need to. They should understand the functions of the various organs and the dependence of one upon another for the healthy action of all. They should study the influence of the mind upon the body, and of the body upon the mind, and the laws by which they're governed. So it's two-way streets, you know, the influence of the mind on the body, and the body on the mind, and the laws that govern them. We're to study the laws of life and conscience obey them. And she talks about some of these laws, and we need to study them most carefully, for unfortunately we forgot about them a long time ago, too many of us. In Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, Paul discusses about this law of the mind. In a sense, Romans 12 and the first two verses, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. Your bodies. It's important that it says that. And there to be a living sacrifice. Verse 2, and be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So something has to happen to the mind, and we're to be living sacrifices. Our bodies are to be that. Not spoiled, not degenerate bodies, you see, not weakened and deformed bodies. But living sacrifice, and the sacrifice would be without blemish. They're to be perfect, without spot, the Bible taught. Present your body as a living sacrifice. And this is accomplished by the renewing of your mind, Paul says. On page 125 of Ministry of Healing, it talks about these laws and how they're to be taken care of. It says the physician stands as a guardian of both the physical and moral health, the first paragraph there. It is his endeavor not only to teach right methods for the treatment of the sick, that's for curing, you see, but to encourage right habits of living, to spread a knowledge of right principles. So the doctor is to teach them how to live right, not just how to get well, but how to stay well, you see. And all of us are to teach some of these things, not only the physician. This will be a great blessing to people. It continues on the next paragraph about these laws. Education and health principles was never more needed than now. And by the way, the world seems to recognize this more than we do. Elder Vanaman told us about a year and a half ago at Pine Springs Ranch that they try to get on national TV, the coast-to-coast hookups there. And they said they denied us of every privilege. But they said, by the way, if you have a health program, we'll put you on. And we had to go back. The most prominent church in health reform. We had to go back and start figuring out programs for national TV because we didn't have any. Didn't have a one at that time. Any program on health, they said, we'll put on for you. And by the way, the need is still there. They're still clamoring for health programs. They get a tremendous listening audience or viewing audience on TV for all health programs. And for years, we've blown our own horn, you know, about how good we are in health reform, and we still don't have any programs to put on. And we put on very few yet. You know, the devil's calling our bluff. He's saying, you think you have something, where is it? And you know, we're still afraid to even talk about it. We're still embarrassed to talk about vegetarianism, and it's in newspapers around the world. Around the world, we're still afraid to talk about it. We're a little embarrassed that there's something peculiar about us because we don't eat meat, you know? The world's not embarrassed. They're afraid they're going to starve to death unless someone shows them how to eat right. Isn't that right? And they're open the door wide open to someone to come and tell them about eating properly. And we're still hiding our light under a bushel. And some of us are still blushing when they say, you mean you don't eat meat? We're still embarrassed. We're living the dark ages of Adventism, you know. We're dark up here. The world is screaming for the light. We said we had the light. And we don't even tell them about it. Afraid to talk to our neighbors about this even. For fear they think we're some kind of a peculiar sect, you see. That day has gone a long time ago. Anybody that watches TV today knows the food crisis in the world. And they know that we're coming to vegetarianism by force. That we must go that direction. The people in nutrition are saying that around the globe. And our people who are experts in this field are in demand every day, practically, to come and discuss this on committees. Education and health principles was never more needed than now. Notwithstanding the wonderful progress in so many lines relating to the comforts and conveniences of life, even in sanitary matters and to the treatment of disease, the decline in physical vigor and power of endurance is alarming. In spite of all the progress in medical science, in modern sanitation, treatment of disease, the decline in physical vigor and power of endurance is alarming. If you don't think so, go out and do what your grandfather did on a farm. Any one of you. Go out and follow a hand plow and plow 40 acres. Just go out and plow. Do that. Any one of you. Let's find the brawny people with endurance, you know. Go do some of those things. Run the hand machines they ran, you know, for days and weeks and months. Go out there and pitch the bundles all day long, wheat and barley and oats, you know. Go out and cut wheat with a hand scythe. You ever tried that in recent years? I watched my grandfather, you know, going down the railroad ditches cutting weeds with a hand scythe. Pick up one of those things. Almost breaks your back just to pick it up. They cut all day long in the hot sun, you know. We aren't the brawny people anymore, you know. Not at all. That day is gone by. There's a terrible degeneracy in this physical vigor and power of endurance. It demands the attention of all who have at heart the well-being of their fellow man. This
degeneracy of the race, you see. Our artificial civilization, that's a quite unusual term, our artificial civilization is encouraging evils destructive of sound principles. And by the way, this is a phony generation, isn't it? This artificial civilization. Custom and fashion are at war with nature. That's many customs and many fashions, not just in dress alone. That's only one of them. They are at war with nature. The practices they enjoin, the indulgences they foster, are steadily lessening both physical and mental strength, she says. Just lessening it all the time, you see, until we go down. Bottom page 126. And bring upon the race an intolerable burden. Intemperance and crime, disease and wretchedness are everywhere. In other words, we've come to the time when society demands the knowledge and light and health that Seventh-day Adventists have been given. Demands it. We are literally saying, if we don't give it to them, I don't care if you die. And I don't care how fast you die. And I don't care how much you suffer. By refusing to give the light God has given to us about health of body, we're saying to the world, we don't care about you. We really are. And all the time we thought we were putting upon them a great group of restrictions, you see. It's so perverted. The devil has deceived us about the light we have until we call light darkness. And Isaiah talks about the curse on people who do that. The world is just really crying out for someone to help them to be stronger physically, to be more healthful nowadays. And we say we have it, but we don't give it. We keep going to school and going to school and going to school trying to learn it so we can give it. But almost no place do they teach this book. And I wonder if you ever find it in our schools. I really do. If you ever find it like it is. And I wonder how many years we'll withhold it from the world while we're going to school trying to find it. It seems ridiculous to me, honestly, it does. How can we let the world die when we have so much help for them in matters of health? And for our children the same way. How can we do that? God hasn't cursed us with health reform, you know. He smiled on us in wonderful grace and blessed his people. And so few have found that it's a blessing, because they really haven't taken it that way. When we understand the Lord is the giver of every good and precious gift, it's the devil who comes to curse us, not the Lord. We'll look upon health reform as a tremendous blessing. They'll help us in so many ways to be stronger spiritually and to be a blessing to the world. Now, many people are ignorant of these laws, and she goes on and describes that in page 126. Many transgress the laws of health through ignorance, and they need instruction. And there are many, many places nowadays you can give instruction in health. Just many places. All you have to do is tell them the what. Not even the how to many of them. They already know how if you're going to tell them what. Most of us need to know the hows. And it's too bad that we don't understand these better. She goes on and compares the right way and the wrong way of following the laws of health. Now, she lays down the laws of health, and she shows you what's wrong and what's right about following them. The wrong way to follow the laws of health is the use of drugs, poisonous drugs. And she has two long paragraphs on that subject. And by the way, you need to go home and refresh your memories if you read them in the past. I'll take a moment to read them. A practice that is laying the foundation of a vast amount of disease and even more serious evils is the free use of poisonous drugs. By the way, there's quite a difference between American physicians and European physicians in this respect. I know by personal experience. And I'm talking about Seventh-day Adventist and non-Seventh-day Adventist doctors. A non-Seventh-day Adventist doctor in Europe is more aware of the toxic effects of drugs than any Seventh-day Adventist doctor I've ever met. Personal friends I'm talking about now. I became ill in Africa because of the use of poisonous drugs. A Russian-Belgian doctor had Belgian citizenship, Russian extraction, said, "We never use those drugs. They're too poisonous." And he opened up a medical book put out by the Surgeon General's Office of the United States Army to show me the toxicity of that drug. I have told the same thing that he told me to quite a few Seventh-day Adventist doctors now, and none of them have agreed. Not a one of them. You may take that as you please. I'm telling the experience. That's my testimony. It's true. It's time we learned that there are poisonous drugs in modern medicine. Hundreds of them. And there are pharmacologists who know they're poisonous. A certain patient went to one of our hospitals in the mission field and had to be treated for parasites. And the doctor took me to the shelf and picked up the bottle of pills, and he said, look at the ingredients in this, Bill. And the first ingredient, this hasn't been a millennium ago, the first ingredient was arsenic. And it could not be changed. There's no other medication for that particular ailment until 15 years later, or 12 years later, something like that. Nothing for it that we knew about in modern medical science. There are people who have to take poisonous drugs because we have nothing better today to offer. We have had some things better in times gone by, but in modern times we don't have them. We've discarded some of those things. John Harvey Kellogg treated malaria with hydrotherapy. Try to find someone today that, when you contract malaria, will treat you with hydrotherapy. Try to find someone in the middle of Africa when you're out there and burning up with a fever will treat you with that. We threw it away a long time ago, friends. You cannot discard light and be children of light. We cannot. We discard spiritual light and we discard physical light. We must be very, very careful, for God smiled upon us when he gave us these things. And we live in a drug therapy age. And don't blame it on the doctor. She doesn't. She said the patients are very impatient. They want immediate relief. And they demand the doctor gives them something to relieve them. And you talk to those who have to administer drugs and they'll tell you about their patients. And you and I have been those patients. Haven't we? So, oh, doctor, I can't sleep. And he gives you something that's mild. In the middle of the night, you say, I can't sleep. Don't you have something stronger? Yes, he has something stronger. But it has stronger after effects, too. And so we clamor for more and more and more. And how few people will take the pains, as she mentions here, to help nature with a body temperature bath to pacify us and get us to sleep sometimes. Because it takes a little time. It takes more time. You know, perhaps 100 times more than just give one pill. And it takes more people. And it costs more money nowadays for wages for more people, as some of you reminded me. And so it's a production line system, and that takes pills. And we become like the production line automobiles, you know. We have a lot of creaks and groans and loose nuts and bolts and everything else. We need to be reassembled again. These are facts, aren't they? They really are. And so it's a two-way thing, the patient and the one who must treat the patient, whether a nurse or a doctor or anybody else. It's a two-way thing, and she discussed it very clearly. She said, we need to be taught, the second paragraph there, the last paragraph, that drugs do not cure disease. They never have and they never will. They do not cure disease. Somehow we get in our minds, you know, that they do. They do not. The antibiotics do not cure disease. They do not. They can assist the body sometimes, and they can also hinder the body sometimes, as she goes on and makes very plain. Now, some people think that all this counsel applied to 50 years ago or longer. If you read all of it, you'll find that's not true. There are still toxic drugs used today. And somehow we only made a scale of toxicity, you see, and tried to use the least toxic drugs if we must use them. Some other physicians have done that. They try to take the least toxic medications and use those. But sometimes the patients don't like those. They're not strong enough. They don't get immediate relief. And we demand that in our age of feeling, don't we? Make me feel better. Don't cure me, make me feel good. As though that were the way out. She talks about those who are lifelong illness because of drug use. And there's some people who can testify to that, including physicians who've endured some of these things. She goes on and talks about the right therapy on page 127, and I recommend it highly, and it's more modern. It's more advanced than anything you can read, so far as I know. The only hope of better things in the education of the people in right principles. Let physicians teach the people that restorative power is not in drugs, but in nature. We discussed that last week. It's not in drugs, restorative power, but in nature. Disease is an effort of nature to free the system from conditions that result from a violation of the laws of health. Disease is a blessing, not a curse. It's an effort of nature to free the system from conditions that result from a violation of the laws of health. When you fight the symptoms and disease, you're fighting the helpers. You're taking away the blessings. A fever is accomplishing good, isn't that right? That's what I understand. Fever helps to burn up some of the germs in the body. It has a method that you can explain better than I can, many of you. It's an effort of nature to free the system from conditions that result from the violation of the laws of health. The laws of health have been violated. You must go back and obey them, you see. In case of sickness, the cause should be ascertained. Unhealthful conditions should be changed. Wrong habits corrected. See, it isn't enough to be made well by a physician. He must tell us how to go back and stop violating those laws so I'll stay well. And so his pocketbook will get thinner for me. And I won't have to pay for the hospital. There'll be plenty come in and take my place. He won't go broke that way. Unhealthful conditions should be changed. Wrong habits corrected. Then nature is to be assisted in her effort to expel impurities and to reestablish right conditions in the system. She talks about the natural remedies and what they are. And friends, are so simple that we don't believe any of them. Pure air, sunlight, abstemiousness, rest, exercise, proper diet, the use of water, trust in divine power. These are the true remedies. Is she a false prophet or a true prophet? What do you say? You know, friends, it's time we decided whether God inspired or the devil. She says that herself in Volume 5, about the last page. It's time God's people decided whether my writings are of God or the devil. There are too many people alive today, some going in medical work, who believe these are of the devil, or they're so old-fashioned that God has forgotten about us in the last 50 years. These are still the only true remedies. There are no others. There are no others. These are the only true remedies. Pure air, sunlight, abstemiousness, rest, exercise, proper diet, use of water, trust in divine power. These are the true remedies. Every person should have a knowledge of nature's remedial agencies and how to apply them. It is essential both to understand the principles involved in the treatment of the sick and to have a practical training that will enable one rightly to use this knowledge. The use of natural remedies requires an amount of care and effort that many are not willing to give. Here's where the time is involved. Nature's process of healing and upbuilding is gradual. And to the impatient, it seems slow. The surrender of hurtful indulgences requires sacrifice. But in the end, it will be found that nature, untrammeled, does her work wisely and well. Those who persevere in obedience to her laws will reap the reward in health of body and health of mind. And the devil will be evicted. The body will be under control of the kingly powers of reason. The Lord will be in control. And we will be more than conquerors through Christ. Friends, I contend tonight that we have grieved the Spirit in an awesome way by believing that science is in advance of this. And you can pray and pray for a revival and the outpouring of the Spirit. And as long as we repudiate this and believe that science is in advance of that, we will never have a revival, not of the Holy Spirit. Might be some Spirit, but it won't be the Holy Spirit. Never. It's an impossibility. Because the devil will continually conquer our bodies and drag down mind and soul until the laws of nature are used in our lives. For they're the laws of God, the creator of nature. And science will never, never surpass the laws of nature in treating disease. Never. Do you realize that we have literally undermined the function of grace in the denial of health reform? We really have. We've undermined the place of grace. God's goodness to man in fortifying his body so that the soul and the mind might have a habitable place, a conducive place for spirituality. By throwing it away, we said to the Holy Spirit, we can do better than you can. Men are wiser than God. Friends, I believe with all my heart that Jesus is coming soon. I believe even more strongly he's waiting for Seventh-day Adventists to believe what God gave us years ago in this book, which is nothing more than amplification of his word. Years ago he gave us these things. And for decades he's been waiting for Seventh-day Adventists to understand and accept the facts that God smiled upon us when he gave us health reform. Smiled upon us abundantly. He was saying, I want you well and not sick. I want you peaceful and happy, not in agony and suffering. I wish for you a long life, a long, healthy life. Only a God who gives every good and precious gift could possibly want that for us. There's no way that could be a curse. No way. May God help us to see there's an intimacy of grace and health in which God has blessed us abundantly. Grace abounding. And may we every day of our lives thank him for this. And pray for the grace to live this healthy life by the marvelous rules God has given us, rules of love, not restrictions, but marvelous liberty. Shall we stand for prayer?
Loving Father, perhaps our minds are clouded. Perhaps we've been instructed incorrectly about health reform. Perhaps we've been given them in a pharisaical way, in a legalistic fashion, and therefore fought against them. Perhaps we have varying views about these things because of the way they came to us. But somehow by thy sweet grace and spirit, may we see that the God of love has really smiled upon us, that we're dear to his heart, that no more than any earthly father or mother does he want us sick and suffering. He wants us to be well, filled with peace and joy, happy in his service. Somehow help us to comprehend the great blessing that is ours and these precious messages concerning health, that the Comforter has come down to comfort his people in these messages, and help us to understand what a part they play in the salvation of our souls. We ask in Jesus' name.